The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening, I looked at the questions that were submitted again, and there was one that kind of struck me, and so I think I'll start with that, but it'll be a little bit broader than the question itself. The question is it possible to be attached to or cling to our meditation practice? And if so, what's the path to not clinging? And I'll start by just talking a little bit about clinging. The teachings, the Buddhist teachings really speak about craving and clinging as being a key reason why we struggle, why we suffer. We crave for things to be other than they are, that we kind of resist or fight what's happening. We want to hold on to something that doesn't last. We want to push away things that are here that are unpleasant. And so we are kind of struggling with the conditions in the world. And the craving is the kind of the desire to the movement towards holding on or pushing away. And the clinging, I would say, is the action of holding on, or the action of pushing away. That we're actively engaged in trying to keep something that's slipping through our hands, or actively engaged in trying to keep ourselves away from something that's unpleasant, that's here. This tendency, I would say, is really human to try to hold on to something that's pleasant, to want the pleasant, to want to get rid of the unpleasant. Really human. In fact, it's kind of like, sometimes I say our system, our human system, kind of wants to move in the direction of ease or peace or happiness or well-being. And, essentially it tries to take the shortest path to that well-being often. And the shortest path to some measure of well-being is often, if I can get what I want right now, I'll feel okay right now. Or if I can get rid of what I don't want right now, I'll feel okay right now. And so it's a little bit of a short-sighted process often, the process that kind of moves us in the direction of well-being. And it's not looking at the whole picture. It's not looking at, in fact, the experience of wanting something, wanting to hold on to something or wanting to get rid of something. That very experience of wanting to hold on or get rid of, the very activity of clinging to something or trying to push something away, that very activity is tension in the body and mind. And the reason we don't notice that, and we don't notice that often until we start to learn something of what the Buddha teaches often, we don't really notice that that activity of holding on or pushing away is itself painful, is itself stressful. Partly because our minds have kind of leapt into the ideas about the having the thing or the getting rid of the thing. We are kind of holding on to the idea of, oh, I have this thing. This is so great. This means I'm good. This means I figured out how to work things out. I've gotten rid of something. Oh, this means I'm okay. I figured out how to do these things. So our minds are not really in the experience in the present moment of the trying to hold on or trying to push away. We're in the idea of, okay, I've got this figured out. So we're not actually experiencing the entirety of what's happening in the moment. And so this is partly why this habit of clinging, this habit of craving, the habit of, oh, I need to get something that I want. I need to get rid of something that I don't want. Why this perpetuates, why it carries on. We lean towards getting something that we want. And we get it. And in that moment of the getting, we have a little bit of kind of that sense of ease, the sense of things are okay. Not only do we have something that we want, but also the kind of feeling of it being a problem that I don't have it has gone away. And also another experience that's gone away in there is the unpleasantness of the wanting. The wanting it to be a certain way, that unpleasantness has gone away. But we're mostly attributing that happiness to the having. You know, oh, I've gotten this thing. So, oh, that makes me feel good. And we don't notice that there's the other pieces at play there. The fact that the wanting has gone away. But the pleasure, the actual benefit of having that thing, it's not a very long-lasting well-being, let's say. There's a little bit of well-being, and the Buddha talks about this as gratification. He says, you know, there is a gratification to getting what we want. So there is a little bit of that kind of well-being in that. It's not a very lasting well-being. It's not a very stable well-being, but there is a little hit of well-being there. And it's kind of like that's that kind of well-being where we get something that we want or get rid of something that we don't want. That kind of well-being is pretty much the kind of well-being that most of us think is how to construct happiness in our lives. If I can accumulate the things that I think I want with me, if I can get rid of the things that I think I don't want with me, then it'll be okay. And so we have this idea of, that's essentially it's like the happiness of the getting and the having, that happiness that comes with clinging. It's like we think that's pretty much as good as it gets. And so we're not really attuned to ways that there might be a deeper kind of well-being or a deeper kind of happiness. And so the practice that the Buddha basically discovered in his own inquiry, his own curiosity about, is there a way or two to alleviate suffering? You know, he in his own experience saw there was a lot of struggle, of suffering, of stress, and his curiosity was, is it possible to be free of this? And he discovered that by looking into his mind, looking at what was happening in the present moment around this process of wanting and having, around this process of aversion, looking at what was going on in the mind around these processes, he saw that it's the very, that very cycle of wanting, having, getting, and then the stress that comes with trying to hold on to it, the sadness that happens if a pleasant thing goes away, a feeling of I've failed or I've messed up, or if we, you know, trying to get rid of something that we don't like, that if we don't succeed, we feel frustrated with that. If we do succeed, then we're continually on the lookout for trying to keep those things at bay. He saw that this was a kind of a perpetual motion machine that in his kind of inquiry was, he kind of discovered or found, you know, this is just based in the nature of the world. You know, the world is impermanent. It's unreliable. There's nothing that's out there in our everyday lives that's reliable as a place for lasting happiness. And so he was curious about, is there a way for there to be some lasting happiness? And so his practices, his exploration was to look into his mind, into the experience, and basically to see that this craving and clinging is a key place where this suffering is put together. And if that craving ends, that craving for things to be other than they are, essentially kind of coming into alignment with the nature of experience as impermanent, as unreliable, instead of feeling like I've done something wrong for things to be impermanent and unreliable, the Buddha acknowledged this is the way it is. This is the nature of experience. It's this uncontrollable, impermanent, unreliable experience. And so looking into that, he saw that the craving to have it not be impermanent, the craving to have it not be unreliable, this is where the suffering is. It's kind of a linchpin that if there can be the ending of that craving, the Buddha says that's the ending of suffering. That when we no longer crave the unreliable to be reliable, we no longer crave the impermanent to be permanent, the uncontrollable to be controllable, there will be an ease and a peace that is much more lasting, a deeper kind of well-being, a deeper kind of happiness. And so he offered us practices. He offered us mindfulness. He offered us wise effort. He encouraged us to look at the habits and patterns of mind that contribute to stress in our lives. He named three key ones, greed, aversion, delusion, as key functions in the mind that keep us caught, keep us stuck. And we are encouraged to explore that with mindfulness, concentrating our minds, practicing to settle the mind down. And as we do that, as we explore that, as we begin to explore what it means to look at our mind and to sometimes settle into the mind in concentration, we start experiencing the pleasantness of meditation. We start experiencing the pleasantness of seeing the mind let go of something. We start experiencing the delight of understanding that it's just a thought that's happening in the mind, and it doesn't need to be kind of hooked into or carried on anywhere. It's just a thought arising, this thought of, for me, you know, the thought of self-hatred, you know, it's like it was so powerful when I could see, oh, this is just a thought. It's just a thought. And in that moment, right then, in that moment, when the mind saw, oh, this is just a thought, the mind shifted. I've told this story many times. I'm telling it in a very brief way here today. The mind looking at self-hatred arising and seeing, oh, wow, this is just a thought arising, and that thought's being believed. And it's like, there's nothing inherent in this thought that it's like, it's not even true. It's just a thought. And so the mind shifted in that moment from kind of caught by self-hatred to seeing that and seeing the self-hatred vanish and then experiencing bliss. And then believing, you know, the next thought was, oh, I figured it out. I've got it now. I'm never going to experience self-hatred again, you know, kind of the clinging to that understanding, essentially. But then fortunately, I did see in that moment, oh yeah, well, this moment I understand it, but probably it's going to happen again in the future. So this was a little small way, you know, that it happened, that in my mind, that it kind of clung to the understanding, the insight, it clung to that. Oh, I figured it out. I'm never going to suffer that way again. And then the mind realized, oh yeah, probably this is an impermanent condition, the understanding of this. And so, to more directly speak to this question, you know, is it possible to cling to meditation practice or to insights, to understanding? It is possible, and it will happen. And it doesn't have to be a problem that it happens. Actually, it seems to be part of how the practice unfolds. You know, to try to avoid clinging to the practice, if we tried to avoid clinging to the practice from the very beginning, we would probably never get anywhere. We wouldn't even start the practice because there's, you know, often many of us, I think, I certainly started this practice with some kind of deep wish to, you know, reading a book and having a friend saying, this is helpful. There's like, I'm so miserable. I sure hope there's something that will help. And it's kind of like, I was holding on to this book and the practices that were suggested, like a life raft. And I was holding on to it. And that holding on, that holding on to it helped me to look at very painful things. So in my understanding of the way the practice unfolds, it's almost like it's stair steps, or it's going through stages. We meet the practice often, we engage, we begin the practice when we really confront some kind of suffering in our lives. Many of us come in through this kind of a doorway where we hear a friend perhaps tell us, you know, gee, why don't you try this? This has really helped me. And that's what happened for me. A friend sent me the book. A friend said, this is helpful. I was miserable. I had hit bottom. It's like, well, I'm willing to try anything. So I don't quite see how it works, but I'm willing to try anything. And so I began trying and to see. So it's like, I hold on to this thing that my friend said would work, and try to look at the things that are so painful. So through that process, you know, I could see in the first year or so of my practice that there was a lot of benefit that I was experiencing from the practice. And it was helping the mind to let go of or navigate in a much more skillful way all of the anger, all of the self-hatred, all of the aversion, all of the being flailed around by my emotions. There was, even in the first 2 or 3 months, there was a lot more stability. And then I began doing some retreats and reading and practicing a little bit more. And it was very clear to me, you know, hearing more of the teachings, that I was holding on to the practice. You know, it was pretty clear that I was beginning to identify as a meditator. I was, you know, thinking I was pretty good at it sometimes. Sometimes I would suffer about that. It was, and this is what happens to us, actually. You know, so this is a little bit of the staged piece. I could see, you know, holding on to the identity as a meditator, holding on to the practice. It was really helping me to navigate some really painful, unwholesome states of mind. The anger, the self-hatred, all of that was allowing me to navigate that, to hold on to the practice. And sometimes I was holding on to the practice for dear life. At other times, I could see that, I'd be holding on to the practice and then the identity with the practice, the identity with, oh, I know how to do this. You know, and we get that kind of feedback. It's like, it helps us to let go of something challenging. And so we feel like, oh yeah, I'm doing it well. You know, I'm doing a good job here. And so we prop ourselves up there. But then sometimes we find out that it doesn't always work the way we thought it would. And we're trying the same thing we tried before, and we're just caught in our difficulties, in our patterns, in our habits. And then we blame ourselves. I'm not doing it right. I'm failing at this. And so then we do suffer because we have identified with the practice. And so the process of clinging to the practice and seeing that clinging is part of how the path unfolds for us. So it's not like we say from the very beginning, I will never cling to the practice. I will never cling to being a meditator. I won't do that. It's like, we can't not do that, because our habits of clinging and identification are so deep. As soon as we find something pleasant out there, something that feels like, oh, that's the way, we'll cling to it. As soon as we find something that feels like, oh, that's helpful, we'll cling to it. We'll identify with it. And so it's almost like built into the path that we will cling to the practice. What I often tell people is, you will cling to the practice. You will be clinging to the identity of being a meditator. Sometimes you'll notice that it's painful, and sometimes you'll notice that it's helpful and that it's helping you to let go of something more painful. So in the case of looking at my self-hatred, looking at my horrendous pattern of anger, all of those emotional ups and downs that I was going through, holding on to the practice, the suffering of holding on to the practice, and there is a tension there, you know, there is a tension within that holding on to the practice, but the pain of the holding on and the being in the self-hatred, way more obvious. And so, you know, while looking at or being with self-hatred, if I'm clinging to being, you know, clinging to the mindfulness that's doing, that's attending to that self-hatred or that anger, probably the suffering of that clinging to the mindfulness is not going to be felt, because it's the suffering of the self-hatred, the anger, whatever else we're looking at, is much stronger. So there's an analogy the Buddha gave that sometimes can be helpful in terms of exploring this phenomenon of holding on to the practice. The Buddha sometimes talked about the path, gave an analogy about the path of practice as crossing over a flood with a raft. And the flood, he describes the flood as the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion. And we are kind of swept away by greed, aversion, and delusion. And so if we see that there's this flood, we might build a raft. And the Buddha equates the raft with the Eightfold Path. So he equates the raft with the tools of practice. The raft is the tools of practice. Wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. All of the things that we do to support ourselves to navigate greed, aversion, and delusion. And so we build this raft, and then we can cross over the flood on the raft. So the Buddha says that we, using the effort of our hands and feet, we are on the raft and we are navigating that flood by being on the raft. So, you know, a couple pieces about this, you know, you're on the raft. You know, a raft is like something you've stuck together out of bits and pieces of things you found. You know, it's not like a major, like nicely built boat. It's a raft. It's got like holes in it, it sticks, you know, you're lying on this raft, you're probably getting wet. You are getting wet with the suffering of greed, aversion, and delusion. But you're staying afloat. You're not, at least you're not drowning in the greed, aversion, and delusion. And think about those currents. You know, sometimes in a flood, the currents are moving really quickly. And if you're on a raft in a flood, you're going to be holding on to that raft. You're just kind of like, you know, lolling around on the raft. You might get swept off the raft. So we need to hold on to the raft while we are crossing the flood. The Buddha does say that once we've crossed the flood, come to the other side of the flood, that it doesn't make any sense to pick up that raft and carry it around with us. And so at that point, he says, we should put down the raft, let go of the Eightfold Path as something that we're holding on to. But while we're crossing the flood, we are probably going to need to hold on to that raft. And so it's not a problem to be holding on to the raft, but it is important to always be curious, is there suffering happening? So for instance, again, in that river, we can keep using this raft analogy for a little while. If you're being swept downstream by rapid currents, you're probably holding on to the raft and, you know, more concerned about staying afloat than you are about the stress in your hands of holding on to the raft. But then if it comes to a period of time where the flood is a little bit more calm, you're floating in a more calm time, then you probably can use more time to make effort to let go of the raft and paddle with your hands and feet and get, you know, move across the flood. And so at that point, if what you're doing is holding on to the raft while you are sitting in calm water, you're probably going to notice the pain of the holding on there. And so this is the inquiry that we keep making. Is there suffering associated with what's happening in the moment? You know, so if we're holding on to the path, the practice, holding on to mindfulness while we are observing something really challenging, it may be necessary to hold on to the mindfulness there. It may be necessary to make that effort to really stay connected with the practice while we're doing that. At another time, if we're making that same kind of effort, we may feel the suffering of it. So another analogy from my practice, I'll try to do this one quickly because I see it's coming to the end here. So for a very long time, investigation was a tool that I really used a lot to kind of look at what was happening, to investigate the suffering, to look at the self-hatred, what was happening, see what was arising, what was connected with it, how did it affect the body, what thoughts were going on. There was a lot of investigation that happened there. And it was really useful. It really helped the mind to be able to understand the self-hatred, to see how much it was believing things, that whole recognition of, oh, this is just a thought being believed. That came through that really staying right with the practice there. At a certain point in my practice, that movement to investigate, to dive in and look at things, was experienced as so much tension. Because what was kind of asking to be seen was not needing that kind of investigation. It was more, the invitation was more relax and just let it show up than you be in charge of figuring it out. And that was a period of time in my practice where I began to understand how I had been really holding on to that investigation, identifying with it. This was a number of years into my practice before I really had to turn and work with that. I don't think it would have worked to have let go of that or to investigate the suffering around investigation much earlier in my practice. But the curiosity the Buddha keeps pointing us to is, where is the suffering? Is there suffering with how you're practicing? Then that's useful to look at. I mean, if the way the mind is engaged with the practice is creating tension in the mind, then it's useful to kind of step back and say, well, what's that? You know, what's that? What's happening there? But if the way you're engaged with the practice is feeling like it's supporting you to navigate something difficult, then, you know, don't worry about whether you're clinging to the practice at that point. It'll show up at some point. If the encouragement is to just notice where there's stress, where there's suffering. Gill sometimes says that practice is self-correcting, and this is how it's self-correcting, because we are curious about suffering wherever it's found, including in how we engage in the practice. But we can't try to avoid that suffering. You know, it's like every one of us is probably going to have to go through that. Sometimes sometimes earlier in our practice, sometimes later in our practice, sometimes both, that we see that we're clinging to the practice. And there's tension and suffering over it. But that's just the next piece, to look at that tension, to look at that suffering. So, oh, there's tension in the practice. What's the belief there? I think I can fix this. Whatever it is, just curiosity about the suffering.